This episode is brought to you in part by our friends over at WebStreet. In fact, you probably just heard them on a recent episode of Invest Like a Boss. It's number 277. We talked to Kyle, their operations manager, and he had teased us that they have a new fund on the way. Well, the time is now. Fund number 6 has just launched at WebStreet, and they're doing things a little bit different this time. As you may recall, WebStreet's previous fund offerings bought and operated cash flowing websites. Well, they're not getting away from that. They're still doing that, but now they've included software as a service businesses as well. Now, these companies may not make headlines like OpenAI or Tesla, but they're vetted, profitable, spin off lots of cash, and make for great passive investments. And in fund number 6, the capital will be spread across a basket of businesses. That means there is no single point of failure and you reduce your risk. And like I said, software as a service is now part of the strategy as well. I know we've had a lot of iLab bosses invest in previous rounds of these funds, and they do sell out fast. So you're going to want to head over to webstreet.co to get all the information. You can sign up for a quick free account. It takes about 30 seconds, and you'll get all the information you need to know before you invest. One more time, that's webstreet.co, webstreet.co.
Welcome to the Invest Like a Boss podcast.
I'm Sam Marks.
I'm Derek Spartz.
And I'm Johnny FD. We're self-made entrepreneurs who invest our own money and use modern technology to invest like a boss.
Join us each week for exclusive interviews with our network of modern investors, business owners, and multimillionaires to discover new ways to invest our hard-earned cash.
Hey, bosses, and welcome to episode 283 of the Invest Like a Boss podcast. I'm here in my not vacation home in Kyiv, Ukraine, and Sam is also not in his vacation home, but ironically in Thailand, very close to one of the many he owns.
And then you're pretty close to one of the ones that you own as well.
Yeah. Mine's actually being rented out and cash flowing, though. What about yours?
It's quite timely that you bring this up, because I'm just starting to rent my second one up north as of six days from now.
Okay.
So I just was just up there cleaning it up and getting it ready, and excited to get a little cash flow on the side of the world.
So you personally went to Chiang Mai just to clean up your apartment?
Not really. It's kind of one of those excuses, like I have a reason to go up there, but it took me not really. I organized like a few things. This is what I did. I could have had anyone do this. I went to 7-Eleven. I bought hand soap, shampoo, and trash bags. And then I dropped it off at reception. And like, hey, when the new customer moves in, can you just drop this off for them?
Why didn't you just go into the room? Why did you put it at reception?
I couldn't find the key.
Your own condo. How funny is that?
But no, the receptionist is great. You know, she was probably there when you used to stay in the building like 5-6 years ago, Johnny. She's still there. She's just great. She's a friend and she just handles everything.
Well, this is a really good intro to this week's episode, which is Vacation Homes 101. Is it worth it financially to invest in a vacation home? Because I think it's a dream for every single American, probably everyone around the world, to have a secondary home somewhere in another country or another part of the country you live in that you dream about going to, that you dream about owning. And I think the dream is definitely real, really real. So before we start popping any bubbles, can we kind of rewind in time and talk about your first dream of owning one? Like, when did you first think of even buying a place?
When I was in college, I went and studied abroad in Switzerland when I was 19 years old. And, total game changer for me at that point in life, just seeing so many things that I didn't even know existed in the world, but also just how awesome it was to experience different cultures and how cool it was to be able to ride a train around Europe. So at that point, I think I always wanted to live abroad or experience, maybe part of the year abroad. And then my first mentor, who actually we had on this podcast, Rob Call, I forget what episode it was, we can go back in time. He was my first mentor and also, basically the first business that I worked for out of college and someone I really looked up to in terms of success and lifestyle. And he was always saying like, hey, in this world, what you want to be able to achieve is basically be able to live a multinational lifestyle, international lifestyle. And that means you need to have a primary property that you live in and 1 to 2 vacation properties abroad. And for some reason that always stuck with me. I'm like, yeah, that's the dream. At that point forward, I was like always kind of looking where I wanted to have a house abroad while I was always planning on my primary residence to be in the USA.
That's really cool. I don't know why I never had these dreams. I think I grew up not even thinking I could afford one house versus right. having vacation at home. So it never really occurred to me until I was in like probably honestly like in my 30s. And that's when I looked in like Thailand. I was like, oh yeah, there's these like, you know, pretty cheap properties, but I always heard horror stories. And then actually when I was in Sri Lanka, that was the first time I ever really seriously considered it and started running the numbers.
Yeah.
There was a pamphlet for a new kind of condo hotel. They were condos, but they were run by a hotel company and they promised, you know, 6 or 7% or even 8 or 9% preferred returns. And the brochure looked amazing. You know, there was like multiple swimming pools, it was beachfront. They're supposed to have a beach club attached to it, a gym, you know, like shopping center, all the stuff. I was like, wow, this is amazing that for $140,000, I can own this and be able to tell my friends and be like, yeah, I have this, you know, property where I can use it up to 3 weeks a year, but every month I'm getting money for it. And also at that time I met an older gentleman, like a, you know, pretty well-off guy. And he told me that he has vacation homes in all his favorite countries. I think he had, you know, he had the one in Sri Lanka, which I visited and was beautiful. You know, he said he had one in like somewhere else in Europe near a mountain, one in the US and one somewhere else. And he's like, yeah, I just, you know, I go to each one for a few months at a time. I have a full-time, you know, housekeeper at each one and I show up, everything's clean. And it sounded like the dream, to be honest. It sounded like the, you know, the rich person thing to do.
Yeah.
But I also realized that financially and time commitment wise, it's probably one of the worst things we can do.
I'm kind of smiling while Johnny's telling this story because I remember vividly when you were in Sri Lanka and you got this idea. And I remember the pamphlet because you sent it to me and you're like, I'm thinking about doing this. And I want to say, I remember my advice to you, which was like, if you want to spend a lot of time in it each year, then it might make sense. But if you're expecting just spend like a month a year, a couple weeks a year and like rent it out and make money, like that might not work. And the reason that my advice was such was because I got myself into a very similar situation in Thailand where the marketing brochure was glossy and looked amazing. There was a guaranteed return of 7% a year. And that just never was or has been the case in the 7 years that I've owned the property. But going back into that time and looking forward to where you're at now, are you glad that you passed on that or do you wish you had gotten it?
I'm so glad I dodged that bullet. I don't think that place ever got built because of COVID. So my money probably would have got tied up. I probably would have been screwed. I'm glad nobody I showed the brochure to wanted to do it either. But it just sounded so good in the brochure. You know, I think that's how people get kind of tricked into this. You know, and not just like the brochure, but like back in the day, I mean, I guess, you know, now it's an e-brochure, like on website. Back in the day, it was a paper printout, which, you know, in some ways is even more impressive. But in general, just, you know, when you're on vacation, like let's say you're in like Tahoe or something and you just, you know, meet like a local real estate agent. They're like, yeah, you can own one of these places here for, you know, 300 grand. You know, I'll rent it out for you when you're gone, or you can, you know, leave it empty, give it to friends or clients. You know, how much, you know, like people would love you if you, you know, had a free vacation home that, you know, your friends and family can use, your colleagues can use. You know, it's like having season tickets to the Mets or something.
Yeah. And how, but you know, of all the people that we know that have vacation homes, including myself, how many people just leave the keys available for their friends and family to go use anytime they want? They're like, hell no, you can't use it. I'm renting it out. Or no, I don't want you sleeping in my bed. Or you can go when I'm there, but like, you're not going to go take a 3 week family vacation in like peak season.
Yeah, it is sad. I was hoping it wouldn't be like that. I was hoping that like the keys would just be available, because I feel like I would do that with my close friends and my family. I honestly, like when I'm not in Kyiv, anybody can use my place, even though, you know, I love this place as my home. I want it to be available to other people. But at the same time, I think it's the mentality of, if we don't mind other people using it, we would probably rent it out. And then if it's rented out, then it wouldn't be available anyways.
That's right. Yeah, you don't want to. That's real money coming in. And I think also people go into it with that idea a lot of times, like, well, this is great. I can have our friends and family, et cetera. And then once they have it and they start making it theirs and it starts feeling like a home and not necessarily strictly like a vacation property, you start tightening up on who and when. And also be frank, it's like, it's not always easy. Like my place in Barcelona, a pretty good friend asked, you know, it was like recently, it was like, hey, could we stay at your place while we're going to Barcelona? I'm like spinning my head. I'm like, oh man, this is like, my place is not an easy place to figure out. Like it's old. Things are delicate. The way electricity goes on and off, the way that you enter and leave the building, the neighbors are sensitive and stuff. I'm just like, man, it's just gonna be a pain in the ass. I'm gonna have to like ship keys to them across the world and like teach them all the things about the security codes and everything. And if that goes off when I'm not there, it's a major mess. And I was just like, it might be easier if you just get a hotel, man.
It's a shame, but I understand. Because actually I think I was in Lviv for a week or something, and I turned everything off. I turned off like the water, turned off the electricity. The electricity was on, but I was going to turn off like certain things just so to kind of leave it empty. And then I had a friend who was going to be in town for one night. And normally like he was always crashing my place, but when I was here, but when he said he was going to be in town for one day, I was like, dude, it's not worth it. Like, it's not worth trying to figure out how to turn back on the hot water and all this stuff for one day, just get a hotel. But so I understand where you come from. It does suck, but I wish it was different. I wish it was like, hey, you know, my place, you know, mi casa, su casa. Here's the codes. And actually, ironically, it makes it easier when you do run your place as an Airbnb, because you have all those processes set up. Everything is turned on. You have a property manager that, you know, if something happens, that they can come help. The keys are probably in a lockbox somewhere, or there's a digital code. But then, yeah, again, as you mentioned, if you're making, you know, $300 a night, and then all of a sudden you have to block those days for your friend, you know, now you're losing $300 a day.
Yeah, where you basically got to ask them to cover like at least the base opportunity costs or something. And it's like, you know, it wasn't intentional that we brought up that specific topic, but that's in line with kind of this comparison of vacation house versus hotel, where, you know, in that case that we just said, it's like, dude, it's just so much easier to show up. You know, you pay $150 for a hotel, and like everything's turnkey, and you got a staff right there that is willing and able to do everything that you need for you during your stay.
Yeah. Well, this is a good time to jump into the financials. So Sam, you actually do own some vacation homes, despite everything that we just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Can we break some of those down?
Yeah, definitely. So we can talk a little bit, or we should talk a little bit about some of our, let's say, more affordable vacation homes. Like you have the places in the Ukraine, especially the one in Kharkiv, because the numbers there are just really like so low on a world level. And then I have a couple places in Thailand. We're talking, these places are in or around $100,000, right? But I think for our average listener that's in English speaking country, generally in the Western world, middle ages, what I did is broke down the numbers specifically of my house in South Carolina, which is still a little bit on the low end of what people are probably anticipating paying for a vacation house. But we thought this is a better comparison for our typical listener. And what we want to do is look at all the costs involved on, you know, setting up the house, the sunk costs of furniture, things like that. And then also the operational costs, which really start to add up, actually, if you're not paying pretty close attention, even for a relatively cheap house, they can get quite expensive. And those are all, you know, those are all sunk costs. So we wanted to look at all of those numbers and compare it to if you just went without getting that vacation rental house and decided, hey, I can use that money literally just to go stay at nice hotels around the world, what that would look like.
All right, well, let's very quickly take a ad break. And when we come back, we're going to break down those numbers. All right. So Sam, let's first talk about your Thailand properties. I think this will be really easy. So aside from the money that you could potentially make from renting it out, how much does it cost you just to upkeep them, to have them? And how many days a year have you actually been using it since you bought them?
Okay. So I guess one of my primary places that I have spent quite a bit of time over the last 10 years, I bought this place 10 years ago, pre-construction. It's in Chiang Mai. It cost 4.5 million baht. So about 130,000 at the time, US. Now, the good thing with these is previously in Thailand, there was no property tax, which was a big reason that I bought the place to begin with. Because coming from the US, where I'd spent most of my time in life to that date, I had a fair idea of what it cost to buy and hold a house, mostly just from talking to my parents about the house that they owned. And property tax was always something that I thought was assumed globally that you had to pay. When I came to Thailand, I realized that they had no property tax. So that took out a big, you know, annual cost right there. And then the you know, the other costs are so low that I figured, well, even if I don't use the place and I just sit on it, and this is when I, you know, had relatively little money, the annual carry costs were very little. So to give you an idea, for instance, the POA, which is a property owner association, or we can just say it like the community maintenance cost, runs about $50, $60 a month. So let's say $600 a year. Electricity when I'm there is low as well. It's maybe in the $40, $50 range. And when I'm not there, it's zero. Internet can be turned on or off. So when I'm not there, again, it's zero. It can be turned on or off monthly. So when I'm not there, it's zero. Property tax was zero. Maintenance, great thing with like that kind of $50 a month fee is it covers everything really in the building. And even if something breaks in your room, like tile, or like I just had a door, you know, kind of a door hinge fall off, cracks in the wall because the building's settling, things like this, they'll come in and repair it. So on an annual basis, it's very low. You know, we're talking on $130,000 property, the annual costs were about $1,000 a year. And just recently, within 2 years, the last 2 years, Thailand instituted a property tax.
Oh, no.
Okay. Yeah, which is like, it's horrible for the market here because it just makes places so much less affordable, especially for foreigners that are kind of like squatting on them like I am.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, property prices have already been flat for 10 years in Thailand, 20 years in Thailand, but now they're really going to be stagnant. But that's running about an extra grand. So something like 1% of the property cost. I'm not sure how they actually levy it. If it is like, in fact, 1% property cost, it seems to be kind of what they're basing it on. So now my cost on that's about $2,000. And to answer your question, Johnny, about how much time I've spent there, every year I have been historically spending about 2 to 3 months a year, and then it's just empty the rest of the time.
So fun fact, me and Sam actually both lived in that same building. That's where we met.
Mm-hmm.
I had a smaller unit, but I was paying much, much less with renting. We had the same facilities, you know, same nice receptionist, the lobby, mm-hmm. same, you know, beautiful swimming pool, same gym, same rooftop. And doing the math, I think my unit wasn't really fair because it was smaller, but on average, you can rent monthly your unit for, I think they go for about $700 to $1,000 a month or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like long term. I've done the math for just the $130,000. You know, this is not talking about the fees, the new property tax or anything. Guess how many nights you can stay there for the $130,000? Off the top of your head.
I would guess you could basically stay there for the rest of your life.
No, but you could stay 5,000 nights.
5,000 nights is 10, was that 15 years or something?
173 months, which is, yeah, 15 years. You're right. So it's like, it doesn't make sense.
Well, here's another thing that I was thinking you were crunching different numbers. Here's another way to look at it. I'm spending, which is not a lot of money, by the way. I think people are listening to this out there and saying, wow, he's only got like $1,500 a year in maintenance cost, like maintenance, upkeep, electricity, all these costs, right? Like I'm paying $30,000 on mine or whatever. But for $1,500, if you went, and I'm only spending 3 months a year there, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can go and live in that same unit. You're right. They're going for like $500 to $600 a month right now. Okay. You can go live in that same unit for 3 months for $1,500 more or less.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same as my operational cost, even if I'm not there.
Yeah.
Right. And then you can keep your $130,000 or put it in the market.
And yeah. So and we're going to talk about the missed opportunity cost a little bit later of mm-hmm. not having your money in the market, because that alone, I think just the $130,000. So right now, on average, if you just have the money in something very basic, the S&P 500, you can almost get this amount just having money in like a treasury bill now. But 7%, it's not hard to get per year.
Over the long term. Yeah.
Yeah, that's $9,000 just in interest.
Wow.
And that's assuming
you paid for the place in cash.
Yeah.
That you didn't take a $130,000 loan on it or $100,000 loan.
And
right?
You're not the one paying the interest on it. So yeah, that would definitely put you in the red. But yeah, if you just had that $130,000, and this is kind of talking to everybody now. So we're not talking about, you know, Thailand specifically now, but a vacation home anywhere in the world, on average, you know, in a nice place is going to be about $130,000 nowadays. And
what?
$130,000? No, $130,000 to for a starting price for like a vacation home somewhere.
No. That's in Thailand and the Ukraine.
That's it.
Like
Yeah, you can't get that.
If you go to North America, like my buddy just moved down to Florida. Mm-hmm. He bought a 2-2 townhome. Zero, uh-huh. You're sharing walls on both sides with other people, okay. Not wide at all, no lawn, in like a suburb of Palm Beach County, $750,000.
Oh my God, that's insane.
Like you can't buy a place in Florida for less than $600,000, right?
Yeah.
You can't, like, even my place, we're going to go into the numbers real quick, guys, of like a North American property that's in one of the cheapest counties of the USA, Oconee County, South Carolina. My place I bought for $300,000. It's now $450,000 because I bought it right in the middle of COVID. But I think anyone listening in the US is like, you can't get a property for less than $350,000. And if that's like a fix me up, you know?
To be fair, I was thinking more like a small like cabin somewhere or like a small condo in like Turkey or Greece or something. But yeah, you're right. In the US, if you want an actual home, if you're talking about like a actual house where you can have guests, like a family, like your family come over. Yeah. $300,000, $400,000.
Yeah, so you raise a good point. We should break, we kind of have multiple audiences here, but we'll break down some numbers for kind of that single remote traveler, digital nomad that are looking at properties more in like the Thailand, Turkey. You raise that as a great option, Greece area. And then we'll also break down numbers of more of like a US based or North American based property.
Okay, so great. So the $130,000, the opportunity cost lost if you had just put that same money in this, S&P 500, really anywhere that's making 7%, that's $9,100 a year, not including your property tax, your maintenance, all these things. So easily it's going to be a couple grand more than that. But, just to make it very easy, let's say we're just working the $9,000. How many nights of that can you get in those same destinations? Because it's not expensive to travel in Turkey, Greece, or Thailand. At maximum, you're going to be paying $100 a day for like a nice place in Thailand. Mm-hmm. That's 91 days a year. That's 3 months a year you can spend in a nice hotel in Thailand, Turkey, or Greece.
Oh, yeah.
It's insane. Like nobody's spending 3 months a year in their vacation home.
And that brought up sort of a related travel hack that if you start staying long-term in hotels or if you're looking to do so, a lot of times if you reach out to the hotel and say you want to stay longer than 1 month, they'll offer you a long-term stay. A lot of taxes, a lot of hotels don't have to pay hotel tax on stays. When you stay more than 30 days, it's long-term stay. It's taxed differently for them. And they can offer a much better rate than that. Mm. And they'll also give you a discount on the long-term stay. So for instance, like in Tahoe one time, I rented out a place during ski season at a hotel. The place was like $250 a night. I got it for $2,000 for the entire month. That's the same as like eight. That's the same as like eight nights stay, right? But just because I stayed more than 30 days, they gave me a massive discount. It was awesome.
That's fantastic. So easily, like I think nowadays with the option of having the hotel, an Airbnb, or another type of stay, $100 a day at these kind of cheaper places, you can definitely do it. So it's kind of like it doesn't make sense unless you're going to be renting out your unit for the rest of the year. And in a lot of places, the only places that actually the only time of the year that you even have people renting is during the summer or during the big season when you probably want to be there.
Yeah. So let's break down the numbers of my property in the US, because then we'll have kind of two different property sets to compare to. And the numbers actually get very, very interesting. In fact, going through this on my own yesterday and looking at the cost, I kind of like was just like, wiping the sweat off my head. Like, wow, I didn't even realize what these add up to each year, because I'm so used to not looking at bills because I have everything set up automatically now that everything just got automatically paid. I kind of see it on my bank statement whenever I go through them every couple months, but I don't really ever add everything up. But this was a really good exercise in doing so. So for the listeners that don't know, I have a place in South Carolina. Right now I'm using it, max 6 weeks a year. I bought it during COVID as like a COVID house and also kind of like, well, maybe I'll live here or maybe it's a plan B house. And I bought it for about $300,000 all in. Okay, now my actual cost on a monthly basis, I'll give you the breakdown into tax, insurance, electricity and water, sewage, internet, property owner association, lawn care. So I think for anyone that owns a house, at least in the USA or in North America, those are pretty common monthly costs, right? And those add up to $10,300 a year. So 10x what my place in Thailand costs, right? And just kind of rounded numbers on those, tax is about $3,000 each year. Insurance is $1,500. Electricity and water, somewhere around $2,500. Internet's $500. Property owner association, which kind of covers like the guardhouse, the community roads, the marina, a little bit on the golf course, that's $2,000. And then lawn care is about $2,000 a month. It's something around $200 each month because I have a big front and back lawn and a lot of landscaping. So while I'm not there 11 months of the year, I still have the lawn crew going and taking care of it, making sure it looks good for all the neighbors.
Wow. And most of those are non-negotiable. Like, there, you know, there's a few that can potentially be less if you're not using as much, like electricity and water. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can ask your internet company to like slow down the speed or drop a tier or something when you're not there, but it's probably not even worth calling in to say, you know, to save $50 a month, you know, and then have to reactivate it again when you need to get there. So those are pretty fixed costs. And actually, even though $2,000 a year is a lot for kind of the POA or the HOA fee, the homeowner association fee, it could be much, much more, because I've seen even condos in the US and Canada that charge $900 a month just for the HOA fee.
It can get super, super pricey. I'm sure a lot of people listening to this in the US or Canada are thinking, wow, those numbers are actually pretty low. There's always like the classic example. My friend and ex-business partner who owned a condo in Miami was about $1 million. Now it's probably a $2 million condo. And he was paying $8,000 a month in property tax and home and HOA fees, like $4,000 a month in HOA fee for his place. That's just to keep the place nice and be able to use like the gym inside and the concierge and stuff. $8,000. I mean,
that's insane.
That doesn't include insurance, dude. Imagine insurance on a penthouse in Miami. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. That's wild. And yeah, it's one of those things. I feel like that's just money kind of just being thrown away if you're not using it. Every month that you're not there enjoying your grass, or you're not there enjoying the pool or the amenities, and especially if you're not renting it out, it just, that's just money that's gone. So it's crazy, because that is $10,000. You know, that is 100 nights at $100 somewhere, or, you know, let's say 50 nights at a nice place at $200 a night. And
yeah,
you know, it's are you even in that area for more than 50 nights a year?
Yeah. So I definitely want to underscore what Johnny just said. So $10,300, that's just sunk loss cost. It's not adding any value to your property. It's not appreciating the value at all. It's just maintaining it so that you can use it and it looks good for your neighbors. That is 103 nights at a hotel at $100 a night. Now, $100 a night in the US, we know that's like a La Quinta Inn, a Days Inn, maybe a Holiday Inn Express, nothing fancy, not where you really want to go take a vacation, but it gets the job done. But if you move that up to $200 a night, now you're talking Marriott's, you're talking Hilton's, you're talking Hyatt's, places you would want a vacation, places you would want to take the family, the beach vacation, the golf vacation, the mountain vacation. That's 51 nights. That's almost 2 months, 2 months a year that you can stay at a nice five-star hotel at $200 a night. Now, if you want to travel abroad, you want to go to Mexico, or you want to go to Thailand, or anywhere, you know, in Europe on the Med, $200 a night gets you really far, right? Especially in like Mexico, Thailand, right? All inclusive. Yeah. I mean, $200 a night in, for instance, in like anywhere in South, capital cities in Southeast Asia gets you one of the nicest hotels in the city. And these are like nice quality hotels. Now, if you really want to, if you really want to go high end, you really want to go luxury, you can stay at the nicest hotels in the world. We're talking $500 a night. This is any place in ski country, in Vail, in Aspen even. Man, maybe not Aspen. It's getting pretty pricey.
This could be like a Ritz-Carlton somewhere, like in Laguna Beach.
This is Paris, Barcelona, Munich. These are the nicest hotels in the world. $500 a night, that gets you 21 nights. So if you don't have that much time, but you want to spend a week in three different amazing places at the world's best hotels, that's 21 nights you could stay by just foregoing buying that vacation rental property and paying lawn care.
That's insane, because most people, especially Americans, are not vacationing 21 nights a year. That's 3 weeks. Most people don't have 3 weeks a year to go on vacation. And most people aren't even spending 3 weeks a year in their vacation house. Like the only way I could see this making sense is if someone's actually, you know, working remotely from there or spending the entire summer the vacation home for, you know, 4 months a year, maybe the whole winter, you know, somewhere, or having it be used otherwise. But this is just the cost of operational costs.
This is non-negotiable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This isn't including the $300,000+ that you sunk into buying the place in the first place, or the, you know, the mortgage and the interest you're paying every month.
Oh, it's getting painful. And before we even talk about interest or the sunk cost of the property or the loss, let's say the opportunity cost of property, I've got two more kickers for you, Johnny. Two more kickers. This doesn't include repair, upkeep, maintenance costs. So I can tell you from having not the place in Thailand again, but place in Barcelona and the place in South Carolina, there's always something, brother. There's always something. For instance, I just had to repair my roof in South Carolina. Now, fortunately, I got insurance to cover it, but I still had to put about $2,000 down.
Ooh.
Something's always on a house, you know, that has long, a property and it's got a basement, loft, wood structure. Something's always breaking. So you got to assume you're going to be paying something out of pocket each year. Maybe just throw in an easy conservative number of $1,500, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that moves up the numbers to 118 nights at a $100 hotel, 58 nights at a $200 nice five-star hotel, and 24 nights at the world's best properties. But that's just one piece. I got one more kicker for you. You want to know what it is?
Oh, no.
I think you have some ideas. We've talked about this before.
What, furniture?
I think this is something. Furniture, brother. Furniture.
So I guess unless you're sleeping on the cot or your place came fully furnished already, which actually it does in some countries. That's why I like places like Thailand or, you know, these kind of turnkey condos that you buy is it actually comes with everything. But yeah, if you're buying a vacation home somewhere, even if it looked beautiful when you toured it, most of that was staging that gets taken away.
Yeah. And if you're buying a property specifically for Airbnb now, I think the standard thing to do is just go and deck it out with like IKEA furniture, pretty cheap, you know, two bedroom or three bedroom place. You can probably reasonably do with just IKEA for 10 grand, I think is kind of the running rate. For my places in South Carolina, it was closer to low 20s, 22. I furnished it fairly nice. And then my place in Barcelona was closer to 30 as a three bedroom place. Again, not super expensive stuff. I didn't go high end, but just kind of middle tier, not IKEA, but middle. So, you know, you got to assume somewhere in the range of 10 to 30,000. If it's just sort of a nice furnishing, nothing luxurious, not going top shelf, but you're also not going, you know, IKEA. But the thing with that, with furniture is are you ever going to get any money back from that?
No, never. Like who's never. Buying a used couch or used mattress or even a used mirror? Like it's not even worth your time normally selling it.
Yeah, maybe you get 10%, 20% if someone comes in and wants to buy it just as a vacation property that they're going to Airbnb, but you're not going to get 50%. You're not going to get 100% for that furniture. And it's very likely you'll get zero because if someone says, no, we don't want any of it, and you're not going to move all that furniture into a new place, what are you going to do with it? You're going to list it and sell it on eBay. Or you're just going to donate it to the army shelter or the home, you know, the Goodwill, the local charity.
You know what? Most likely you're going to spend $500 to get someone to come haul it away. That's what my parents just did recently when they wanted to clean out my room. Yeah. They literally like, I have this old, you know, 400-pound TV, CRT TV in my bedroom still. And they wanted to get rid of that, bunch of clothes, bunch of stuff. And I was like, oh, just donate it. And they're like, to where? Like, you want us to haul this like in our car? Like, so they just hired a crew, paid them $500. They came, they took away all the basically trash, right? I mean, it's old furniture, old electronics, old clothes that nobody really wants. Maybe they resold some of it. Maybe they donated some of it. But a lot of it probably just went to the dumpster.
Yeah, man, you're right. So the numbers get actually quite ridiculous when you start including the sunk cost and the loss of furniture. So I use just an easy conservative number saying you're going to lose 10 grand on furniture the first year because you're going to buy it all in the first year, but you'll lose it whenever you sell the place. Maybe you lose more than that, but you're definitely going to lose 10 grand worth of value in furniture. So when you put in that, you can put that into year one number. Just say you're putting in, you're going to lose 10,000 on furniture from buying it. We'll just put that in the year one. That now moves up your nights that you can get in a hotel on the first year because you're going to lose that 10 grand plus you're going to have the 10,300 in operating costs plus the 1500 in repair and upkeep. That moves up your year one hotel stay to 218 nights at a $100 hotel, 108 nights at a $200 hotel, and 44 nights, a month and a half, 6 weeks at the world's best hotels by just foregoing all those sunk costs that you're going to incur.
Yeah, because if you're going to destroy someone's furniture, you might as well destroy the Ritz's and not your own. And you know what? It's funny because
that reminds me of like what's that movie Home Alone when the kid's staying at like presidential suite and he's just like going around crazy ruining stuff. Yeah, you can do that for 6 weeks, guys and girls.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing is, even though I told myself when I buy my own place, I'm going to buy hotel quality duvets and pillows and mm-hmm. bed because I want that experience. When it actually comes down to it and you're like, man, I've already spent 20 grand on furniture. You start kind of, you know, looking like, okay, you know, I don't want to spend $600 on a duvet. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a blanket. What's the cheaper option? Or, you know, I don't want to spend $2,000 on a bed, on a mattress. Like what's a slightly cheaper option? So you could take that money that you would save and just, you know, basically sleep on, like literally sleep in the Ritz, like for two, 3 months a year. It's insane when you break down these numbers. And here's something that mm-hmm. we didn't talk about is most of us listening to this are small business owners or freelancers or entrepreneurs. And we have some way of just writing off a lot of these hotel stays as expenses.
You're right.
We're getting, you know, credit card cash back on it. We can get 3% back on these hotel stays. Mm-hmm. You can schedule a meeting at the Ritz when you're staying there, you know, in whatever city you're going. Like, and all this becomes even cheaper.
And if you're like an Instagram influencer, you've got enough content for a year by staying 6 weeks at Ritz-Carlton's around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. But okay, so I'm going to play devil's advocate. People are going to chime in and say, but Sam, this money is getting thrown out the window if you're just renting hotels. You're not building equity. Housing in the U.S. is, you know, growing every year. You know, you yourself have said your property that you bought for 300 something grand is now worth 450. What about the houses going up in value? What about that?
Yeah. Well, I think there's multiple reasons that people do buy the vacation home. I mean, for people that have the money that they don't have to worry about it, I think it makes sense. I mean, Johnny, you and I have both talked about how nice it is to have homes. You know, we went from kind of being nomads fully to having homes. And I think we felt differently at different times, but generally it's felt good. I mean, you're living in a war-torn city, but if that wasn't the case, I think you'd really love and like your place and probably also the place in Kharkiv. But there is a huge bet for most people that the property price is going to go up. Mm-hmm. But since we've been adults, there's been two times at least that property prices have not gone up, right? And we're in one of those times right now. So I got lucky. I bought right in the middle of COVID and then we got the COVID bounce. But now, at least in the US and North America, we're seeing housing prices start to go down. In fact, most places around the world, I talk to people, Hong Kong, UK, not sure about Australia, but Hong Kong, UK for sure. People are like starting to get in a lot of trouble with their mortgages and housing prices starting to fall. So if I had waited and bought my place now or 6 months ago or a year ago, and I had a variable interest rate, now I'm paying 5% on this and the housing price is going down. I mean, that's a terrible thing, right? It's just most people believe that housing prices are going to appreciate.
And you know, they generally do, but
they do.
At the same time, people don't realize that other things appreciate as well, including, you know, stocks.
Well, statistically, properties globally appreciate with inflation and that's it. So you're better off investing in the S&P 500 historically.
Okay, well, let's use your house as an example.
Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. Because we always hear these stories where you bought your place for X amount, now it's worth X amount. Right. So for yours, was it 350 that you bought it for?
300.
300. And now it's worth what?
It's probably worth about 400 if you could sell it. So, now but I will say houses are not moving in the community anymore.
Yeah. Okay. I can see that.
And because of the liquidity.
And also a lot of people don't realize this, but when you buy or sell a house, you're paying tons of fees mm-hmm. to your agents up to like 5%.
Right. Yeah.
And you're paying tax. Mm-hmm. So people don't realize that on a $300,000 house, the closing costs can be, 6-7% or something? you know, at least five, right? That's 20 grand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So right there.
Exactly.
That already cuts out a lot of the profit. When you sell, it might be another 20 grand. So without even including that, do you remember what month you closed on your property or you bought your property?
21. I want to say October 21.
Okay. So October 2021. So if you bought the S&P 500 on that day, so let's say instead of the 300 grand going into the mm-hmm. into the property, you bought $300,000 worth of S&P 500. You would have bought each share for $4,350, right? Which actually would be the top. So actually, in this case, that would have been a wash because it's basically the same now. But if you bought it actually during a few months prior, so let's say you bought it in October 2020, you actually would have made 25% on the S&P 500, okay. Which is exactly the same as your...
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's one of those things where a lot of it's timing, a lot of it's luck. It's kind of unpredictable. We always hear the stories where people made a ton of money on the property, but mm-hmm. we never hear the stories where people lost money because they just don't talk about it.
Oh, well, I have two other properties. One, you know, my properties in Thailand, I bought 10 years ago. They haven't moved. And I'm not sure I could even sell them, frankly. If I could sell them, probably not at what I paid for them, which is crazy. Because I, you know, you look at those properties and you're like, wow, they're only 130. You got to be able to get your money out of it. Well, not really. And same in Barcelona. And I've only owned the property in Barcelona for about 3 years. But in Barcelona, you have to pay all the property tax up front, basically, which is 10% of the property value.
Wow.
So the place is $1 million. When on closing, you have to pay $100,000 in tax to the city. So you have to hold the property long enough to just get that out. Now, I don't even think, especially now with interest rates as high as they are, there's no liquidity on places in Barcelona. So if I wanted to sell my place, there's no way I could get my money out of it. So there's no telling when it will come back. I mean, so much bearing on interest rates. But I also have to clear that 100 grand. And then I have to clear again, like you said, like another 8% in closing costs. So I really need like a 20% lift just to get my money out of it. Yeah, I think the US housing market's kind of a good example. Like capital cities in most of Europe have done well over the last decade, two decades, but it's not always the case. And with interest rates as high as they are now, you know, if they stay high for years, you don't expect housing prices to go up.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, really good breakdowns. I think this is kind of food for thought. It's a lot more fun to dream about owning a vacation house than it is actually to own, because they are going to be a pain in the ass. I think they've done some kind of math saying a house usually costs about 1% of its value to maintain, you know, to fix, mm-hmm. to rebuy furniture, to repaint, to, you know, things happen. It's the house itself depreciates while the land or the kind of ownership might, appreciate. So mm-hmm. ends up usually, you know, you're better off. And it's a great savings vehicle, right? So I think that's kind of the biggest argument for owning property in general is, you know, at least you're putting the money into something, you're kind of being forced to, versus if you didn't invest anything at all, you might just end up, you know, with nothing at the end of the day anyways. But if you're smart about it, there are better ways to invest your money, but it is intangible. I mean, I don't know. Like in some, let's quickly argue the opposite. In what circumstances and for what reasons has owning the place been invaluable? Like, you know, maybe not monetarily wise, but like maybe is it just having a comfortable place to stay when you're visiting your parents and you don't have to stay on their couch?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it, you know, a reason to go back? Like, what are some of the intangibles that have made it worth it?
Well, we have to remember, we're living in the era of Airbnb, where 10 years ago, 15 years ago, that wasn't really an option. Renting out your place to strangers was kind of a weird thing, unless you bought your house specifically as a vacation rental property. But really, it's like the last 10 years that this has become mainstream. So anywhere before 10 years ago, you're buying a place, it was literally your vacation house. You left, you locked the door. That was it. You show up, you clean it up, you vacation for a bit. So the value proposition of buying a place, renting it 10 months of the year, making it produce income for you, and using it a couple months a year is still pretty high. Airbnb doesn't seem to be producing like it used to, but it's still where it probably makes sense. If you're buying a place and you're just closing it up 10 months a year, or more, you bet, you know, you really need to have the money to not even worry about the financial decision, right? And if you're buying a vacation home without the cash to do so, and you're taking out a mortgage because you don't have enough money to pay for it, well, that's just a retarded decision, frankly, because your mortgage interest on my place alone, if you took out a $300,000 loan, 30 years at a 5% interest rate, and you put down, let's say you put down 20%, your mortgage payment's something around $1,600 a month. So all the numbers that we already broke down for you add $1,600 and the numbers just get absolutely ridiculous. So that would be, you know, if you didn't have the money to cover it and you weren't comfortable kind of just with that financial decision, you know, even if you didn't use it, that would be kind of a crazy situation unless you're planning to Airbnb it and at least cover your interest costs. But the other intangible benefits, I will say, yeah, there's a lot of times I feel like it's a total waste with my properties and the fact that I'm not using most of them at least 9 months a year. But I don't really enjoy traveling anymore. Like, I like going to my homes, right? I like going there, and I travel literally with a backpack. I have a closet there. I know the people in the building. It's home, you know, it's home. And I like that feeling. So I'm not planning to, you know, I am in a fortunate position that I don't need to worry about the opportunity cost or the fact that I could be going around to hotels and staying 2 months a year at really nice places for the cost that I'm paying. I'm quite happy with them. And it's more of a, I would say it's more of a, yeah, it's more of like a, what is it? It's like a
lifestyle benefit, I guess. Like
the lifestyle benefit. Yeah. It supports my life. I would hate to be going to like Barcelona right now and renting a hotel and like living out of a suitcase. You remember all those conversations we had where like, man, we're just like living out of a suitcase just sucks, right?
Yeah. But you know,
do you remember that, Johnny? Or you still enjoy it?
Life was simpler when I was living out of a suitcase. Mm. You know, having less stuff really makes life easier, I think. I really believe that. I wish I would have done more of a hybrid where I would have been like, you know what? I'm going to be here for 3 months at this Airbnb. I'm going to buy a $200 monitor just so I can have a comfortable like workspace when I'm there, or mm-hmm. use it to watch, you know, Netflix. And I'm just going to leave it when I go, you know, it's $200-$300, you know, and nowadays you could literally buy, you know, a 27-inch 4K monitor for $200 or $300 and just, you know. Before I was like, I'm just going to suffer and just not have a TV at all, or not, you know, or just like stare at this 13-inch mm-hmm. laptop. But I think there was a hybrid, you know, same thing with clothes. That was one thing that I was pretty good with, where I was like, okay, I'm going to go to Thailand. I'm going to travel there with just a small backpack, but I'm going to buy a bunch of, you know, cheap t-shirts or like quick dry shirts from Decathlon. And when I leave,
yeah,
I'll just leave them, you know, I'll donate them or give them away or something. And that helped a lot. Or even, you know, buy kitchen stuff, you know, say, you know what, I'm going to be here for a few months. I'm going to buy a blender because I like making smoothies or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, so I think there is a benefit of owning stuff and having things that make you happy. But at the same time, just having a bunch of stuff normally ends up cluttering our lives and making it more difficult.
And maybe it's the considerations like, okay, if you're thinking about buying a vacation home and you have these thoughts, you have this data and this information now to kind of consider, I can say that where I've gotten the most value of my place is the cheapest place. It's the place with the least amount of stress, the least amount of fuss, the least headaches, and it's surrounded by the nicest people. And that's in Chiang Mai. It's where things are easy. The cost, like I don't think about the wasted money, you know? And it's like the wasted money is not financially important to me, right? But I think as moral, ethical, like hardworking people that have gotten ourselves in this position, we don't want to be wasteful, right? We never really want to, we never feel good when we're wasteful. So I'm like looking at this property in the States and I'm like, man, I'm spending like 15 grand a year just like gone out the window to take care of the lawn and stuff. I kind of feel like it's a waste, right?
Yeah.
And so when you feel that way about that property, you're going to enjoy it less.
Yeah.
When you feel like you're getting really good value out of something, you're going to enjoy it more, I believe. So maybe you're thinking about getting that vacation property instead of getting maybe the place that is like the poshest or the best address or the best location or the nicest amenities, et cetera. Maybe take a step down. Maybe go outside to the suburb, get a place that's in a quiet area. Maybe it's a fixer-up home. Maybe it's where taxes are low or you're surrounded by nicer people or something. But you're going to feel like, hey, if that place sits 8 months a year, I'm going to get, it's okay because it's so low maintenance and like maybe you're going to enjoy it that much more instead of thinking about all the bills and the headaches and the lawn care and everything that you're gonna have to pay while you're away.
I'm gonna add on to that with a little thought experiment that I've been having. This is something I might actually still end up doing.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason why I haven't pulled the trigger is I don't know if I actually want to come here every year. And then secondly, I don't know what area specifically I want to be in. So this next year, I'm going to kind of Airbnb in a few different locations in the Jomtin, Thailand area. Mm-hmm. And because I was very tempted to buy one of these shiny places, you know, maybe not the brand new $130,000 condos, but I was thinking, you know what, maybe I'll buy a place that's already depreciated for 60 grand. That's by the beach, and just, you know, have it. If I rent it out and I break even. If not, you know, it's cheap enough where I just have a place. I can lock in the cost of it, so I never get priced out of the market. Because mm-hmm. that's the one thing that I think most people are most afraid of, and the reason why people do buy is the kind of FOMO of being priced out of that area. And it makes sense. If there's one specific area or city that you know you want to go to every year and prices are going up for rent or hotels, Airbnbs, and you're just afraid, like, you know what? I have to buy a place in San Francisco because my parents live there. I want to visit them every year. And if I don't buy it now, it's going to be, you know, one day it might be too expensive. San Francisco is a bad example because it's already too expensive. But
right.
Let's say, for example, Chiang Mai or Jomtin or something, somewhere I really like that I don't want, you know, one day to be like, crap, now it's too much. I can't go anymore.
That's Portugal, man. That's Portugal.
Yeah. So it's a really good example. What I'm going to do instead is I'm going to find a place that I really like, and I'm going to consider just renting it and having a three-year, you know, lease on it, because I've done the math and it's so cheap. These properties that cost about 100 grand to buy in Thailand, mm-hmm. you can rent them for 300 bucks a month if you do it long term. And like per year, that's 3,600 bucks, you know, which is about about what you would spend just maintaining the property anyways.
Mm-hmm.
So even if I was only there a few months a year, even if I, you know, didn't end up renting it out, it would be fine because it's a $3,600 a year expense that you don't have to worry about.
Yeah.
And I guarantee if I had a place in Jomtin that was sitting empty, I would happily have my keys in the lockbox and say, you know what, Sam, Derek,
that's all right.
Whoever's in town, go use it. It's just sitting there anyways. You know, it's in a condo, so I don't have to worry about lawn care or, you know, maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a rental, so I don't really care that much about it anyways. I'm not so prized, you know, like, yeah, I'll have some of my stuff in there, but it's a vacation home. So I might have a PS4 in there. I'm not going to have my brand new PS5 in there, you know.
Right. Yeah,
I'm going to have some, you know, I'm going to have some shorts and some, like, you know, some quick dry shirts. I don't care about that much. Yeah, go ahead and use my snorkel gear. Like, go ahead and use whatever's in the closet. You know, it's there.
No, I still think like Jomtien area, that whole strip of beach is still got to be one of the best values globally. Like, you buy a nice place, decent place, 40,000-50,000. It's an hour and a half drive from Bangkok. And, you know, if you're in the area, lock it up, almost no maintenance costs. Also, in hindsight, damn, Portugal, for people on the East Coast of the US or North America, that was amazing opportunity because mm-hmm. it's basically the same flight from the East Coast US to Portugal. It's mm-hmm. 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a way nicer plane than flying from the East Coast to West Coast in the US on like shitty 3x3 Airbus A320 United, right? You fly on like a, you know, a 777 or a new Airbus 350, and prices there, you know, have gone up 2-3 times in the last decade. Beautiful country, great wine, awesome climate, good culture. That was, you know, but people are definitely getting priced out now, and they just canceled the golden visa in large. I think there's some areas that you can still do it in, but they're kind of the areas that no one's really looking to buy in.
Yeah.
Which is pretty smart by the Portuguese government, I gotta
say. Yeah, I think it got flooded. I think it was one of the best deals out there at the time. So there's something out there, and there's some side benefit, like getting permanent residency or potential citizenship somewhere. You know, that's another mm-hmm. another topic. We can discuss that in another episode. But in general, there are alternatives to buying a vacation home. And financially, it is almost never worth it unless you already plan on having it be a cash flowing property and that property is going to appreciate in value, because the places in Thailand that are not very maintained, that they're just building next, you know, newer condos next door, are not going to appreciate as history has told us. So I want to end with this. Here's an alternative that I think neither of us thought of. If there's a place like that you have to visit every year, but you don't want to, like, for example, parents. I love seeing my parents, but I don't want to live in my parents' house, even though there's a guest room. Like, it would be terrible mm-hmm. to sleep on the couch like that, you know, mm-hmm. but even if they have a guest room, and I think in your parents' house, what do they have? Was it a guest room or where were you staying?
Oh, man, my parents' house has the best setup. My parents' house is like, it's not a big house, but it's four levels, right? They live on the very top. There's the main room. Then there's a cutoff basement that's its own like floor. Uh-huh. And then below that's an outside kind of like deck area. So it's technically four levels. And I could have the whole basement to myself. It's got a kitchenette, bathroom, bedroom. But still, like after being there for like a week or something, you're like kind of, man, I really want my own space. And they're kind of like, yeah, we kind of are used to living by ourselves.
Okay. Well, I think
you know how it is.
Yeah. I think it's hard to be under the same roof. But one thing that makes it feel separate is if it's an actual separate building. So this is a thought experiment for anyone who has parents that they want to visit, but they don't want to live under the same roof. Take that 30 grand that you would have spent each year and build them an ADU, an accessory dwelling unit, your own little tiny home in, you know, on their land somewhere, that way you have a separate building. You can keep your stuff there. You can treat it as, you know, as your private space. And because they physically have to walk out of their house across the yard to get to it, it feels like a separate home. It feels like you're living in a house next door.
Hey, and when they leave you that house in your inheritance, it's got an extra 30K value.
Easily.
Yeah.
Easily.
Not a bad idea. Not a bad idea.
All right. So guys, if you enjoyed this episode, please like it, share it, give it a little rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you listen. Sam, it's been fun. Appreciate you agreeing to let me have the keys to your Barcelona flat whenever I want. Everybody heard it here on the podcast.
I better go before interest rates drop and I sell the place. But if you guys are out there thinking of buying that vacation house, if you're thinking about taking out a mortgage to buy it, maybe instead you can think about telling your sweetheart, hey, instead of buying that house this year, let's put it off for a year and let's go spend 51 nights at a 5-star hotel anywhere in the world, darling.
That would be easy. And I guarantee you'd be way less stressful.
Yeah. That sounds so much cooler. Hey, let's go stay 21. No, no, wait, what is it? 24 nights minimum. 24 nights minimum. All right. Because these numbers can get way higher if you're buying a $500,000 house, $1 million house, you're taking out mortgages. Let's just say minimum 24 nights at the world's best hotels this year. We're going to do one in Mykonos and one in Paris. Then we're going to go to Napa for harvest season. And then we're going to go to Vail for ski season. We'll stay at Ritz-Carlton's. And it's just going to be romance.
I agree, Sam. So
Or bromance.
I agree. Let me know when we're going. I'll be there. I'll pack light. Don't worry.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, guys. See you in the next episode.
Thanks for listening to the Invest Like a Boss podcast. Join our mailing list at investlikeaboss.com to get exclusive access to our insider investment portfolios and our private members forum.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends and leave us a review in the iTunes store. It helps more than you know. See you guys next week.